Blog Talk Radio.
Barefaces Legal Radio, Saturdays, noon to 1:30 Eastern Time, Pacific Time, 9 a.m. to 10:30 a.m. Learn about your bareface rights and help keep us without face diapers.
Looking for something different? Looking for something fun? Join Dan every Monday on the Freedomizer Network, 9 to 10:30 Pacific, noon to 1:30 Eastern, for Common Sense with the Educated Redneck, Dan Ellison, the show about everything and nothing at all.
Join me, Dahl Arntzen, your host, Fridays, the Alaskan Patriot Network. I will bring you conservative views and news, both at home here in Alaska and around the world. So be sure to tune in Fridays, 2 to 5 p.m. Alaska Daylight Time, the Alaskan Patriot Network.
All right, and I want to welcome everybody to Everlasting Covenant, Free from Paul. It is 2023, January 1st, and we want to wish everybody a wonderful year and recognize the fact that January comes from Janus. We realize that we are attached to the Gregorian calendar for appointment's sake, but we do recognize that the actual calendar year for the set-apart one starts much later on in the spring. There they are. Hi.
Hey.
Shalom. I saw you and then I didn't. And then I think I was speaking on mute to my audience, so
muted.
We're all here now.
We're all alive.
I thought, I hope I didn't. I was trying to bring you on, and my finger wasn't anywhere near the red X, but you disappeared.
Okay, I think I went to look at Messenger to see if I had any messages.
Oh, okay, and that disconnected you by accident?
Yeah.
All good.
So we're back in action.
Wonderful. Well, once again, welcome to Everlasting Covenant, Free from Paul. And we are a fellowship that meets on Sundays at 9 a.m. Pacific, 10 Mountain, 11 Central, and noon Eastern. We're here for an hour and a half, and you can reach us by calling area code 319-527-6208. You can also listen to the discussions by going to www.freedomizerradio.live, and that's freedom, I-Z-E-R, radio, so you're going to have two R's in a row, .live, and then you'll see a listen live button up there. You can just listen there if you ever decide that you want to call in and ask a question or join the discussion. Again, that phone number is area code 319-527-6208. And we have been on air now for 2 years. It's actually 2.5 years, but the first half a year my program was a little bit different in nature, and it kind of evolved over to where we are now because of epiphanies and understandings through study that occurred with me and my decision to make what's most important in the world my focus. And then sometime after that, I met Chris and Brandy, and they joined me. So very glad to have you guys. We've actually been on air together almost a year. I think you guys came around in, I think you joined me as a guest in January, but you came around consistently either late February or early March of last year. So it's hard to believe how time flies. Certainly wonderful to have you guys. I'm blessed by you every time we are able to get together.
Aww.
It has been a wonderful experience.
Yes, and we appreciate the opportunity to just be able to have conversations and know that, I mean, this platform to me, that's what that provides, is to be able to have conversations and not necessarily everybody believes the same way, but through us being able to converse on those things, we each individually grow, and that's where I appreciate this fellowship, because we've been involved in other fellowships where that's not the case, and people can't be free to have their own thought or their own critical thinking if it doesn't align up with someone else's. This place is pretty cool.
Well, exactly. And unfortunately, what you have when you disallow other ideas is you have the formation of a denomination. And that is an environment where the individuals in it tend to stop seeking on their own and start believing as the group. And that's actually why we formed in the way that we did as far as Everlasting Covenant Free from Paul, because Paul, as the prophecy stated in Genesis, when Jacob gave all of the prophecies, I started to say blessed all of his sons, but when he got around to Benjamin, he didn't bless him, he cursed him, or prophesied that his line would be cursed, and out of that came Paul. And so we are free from that curse. We are under the blessing, and we are not deceived that being for the law is a blessing. We're not deceived that it's a curse, as Paul states, to be under the law. And I tend to agree with Paul that we are not under the law, because if the law is in us, if something's in you, you can't be under it necessarily. His perspective is one of trying to release us from the law, as though it is a curse, and he outright states it is. And in fact, to be under sin and actively transgressing from the law, or transgressing the law, is the curse. And so good is being called evil and evil good in his case. So it's really wonderful to be free of all of his denominations and to have that in common, I think, is an amazing thing. And there aren't any major points that you guys believe that I outright disagree with. I've got things that I have on the shelf that I just simply do not understand very well. And That's one thing I try to consistently make very clear to my audience. I'm not here as a teacher. I can share with you what I know and what I'm seeing and what I've discovered, but I'm not here as a teacher. I'm here on the equal playing field as any of my guests that come on, my co-host, you guys. I just want to be dedicated to the platform so that we can all grow. So it's really wonderful to have that fellowship with you guys.
Praise Yahweh.
Yes, absolutely. One thing I have found very positive about the program over the years is that when times come up in my life where things become more difficult for me as a set-apart one, as a set-apart person, as one dedicated to the set-apart lifestyle, I find that the strength that I gain from fellowshipping here and knowing that that fellowship is coming, even from the theme music and just the things that we've been able to discuss here and ground ourselves in him. I'm a single woman. You guys are married, so at least you have each other. But I have a next door neighbor that's very amazing and sweet, and she has a lot of tendencies toward our thought process, but not completely there in the literal realm. I think some people walk in this and they don't really even understand that they are walking in it, because the literal coming out of Paul or holding on to Messiah's words versus his is not quite as they're not quite as aware that they're thinking in my faith without works is dead type of thinking is anti-Paul. They just find him annoying. And I remember that stage where I thought he grated on my soul and my spirit, but I didn't quite yet understand the magnitude of where he was going with things and basically holding the door open to the wide gate. And being able to comprehend that is quite a huge thing to do. So at any rate, I found just having other people to touch base with has been remarkably wonderful. So I hope that there are people out there that tune in and are able to connect with the truth on that matter at the very least. And again, feel free to call in if you guys want to join us. It is January 1st, 2023. And here we study the old path referred to in Jeremiah 6:16. This is what the Father says, stand at the crossroads and look. Ask for the ancient paths. Where is the good way? Then walk in it, and you will find rest for your souls. But what did the people say largely? We will not walk in it. That's always so sad to think about, being in the shoes of Yahuwah, wanting his people to know him, and they refuse. They wanted to walk in their own way. So that's why we do this broadcast. We want to walk in the old path, study the prophets, the lost books, the words of the Messiah only, free of the lying pen of the scribes, referred to in Jeremiah 8:8, which I believe is making reference to the fact that there is even lots of error in the Old Testament. How can you say we are wise and the law of the Father is with us, when in fact the lying pen of the scribes has produced a deception? Black shall be called white, white shall be called black. So we study free of the opposing gospel, according to Paul, free of the religious corruption, and also free of the influence of the Roman Catholic Church, which we believe, or I believe, is the grand entity that came out of the Pauline philosophy that we know in his 13 epistles that he wrote down, or that he articulated and were written down in some cases. So we could continue on with Jesus' words only chapter 10, or if you guys have another direction you have in mind. I know we're trying to get to a place where we're more dedicated to touching base during the week, but when we wing it, the Father always seems to show up, and we still have very enlightened broadcasts. So it's up to you guys. What would you like?
Look into the Word.
Jesus words only.
Let's go ahead.
See what chapter 10 is about.
Yeah.
What was that?
We'll see what the next chapter is about.
Okay,
can
sure.
Can we do the reading, and then we'll look into the chapter, see what it's about.
Sure. So chapter 10 of Jesus Words Only by Douglas J. Del Tondo. This was a man that was actually Jesuit trained. He got a law degree. He was a very strong, traditional Pauline Christian, didn't even understand that there was a way called the Way that came before the Pauline Christians. And he visited a foreign country and noticed that the Christianity there looked much different and resembled what he had read in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and he became very curious about this way where people were actually strictly following the words of, he refers to the Messiah, Jesus. We do not, due to removing leaven from our lives and realizing that Jesus is not his name, but just giving you some background there for anybody that's tuning in for the first time. So chapter 10, did Jesus applaud the Ephesians for exposing Paul as a false apostle? Is there a 13th apostle? It is hard to imagine that Paul's 13 letters never came to the attention of any of the 12 apostles. One would expect to find some testing by the apostles of Paul's claim to be an apostle. Jesus in Revelation 2:2 mentions the trial of Ephesus of persons who told the Ephesians they were apostles. The verdict found they were not true apostles. Jesus told the Ephesians, I have known thy works and thy labor and thy endurance, and that thou art not able to bear evil ones, and that thou hast tried those saying themselves to be apostles and are not, and hast found them liars. That's Revelation 2:2. In Revelation, Jesus did not say the same thing to any of the other six churches whom he addressed. Jesus made that remark to the only church among the seven whom we know Paul visited, the church at Ephesus. And among the seven churches, it was only the church at Ephesus whom we know Paul told that he was an apostle, Ephesians 1:1. Paul wrote this church from Paul, chosen by God to be an apostle of Christ Jesus, to God's people who live in Ephesus and are faithful followers of Christ Jesus, Ephesians 1:1. Turning the page. Jump in whenever you would like. If Paul were the object of Jesus' remarks in Revelation 2:2, it then makes sense that only the church at Ephesus would be commended for trying someone who told the Ephesians that he was an apostle. To the Ephesians, and to them alone, Jesus commends them for testing the one who said they were apostles and are not, but are liars. Now it was to the Ephesians that we likewise know Paul said he was an apostle. Was Paul not an apostle, thus bringing Revelation 2:2 directly to bear on Paul? Indeed, there is no evidence for Paul being an apostle except from Paul's own mouth. As Siegel mentions in Acts, Luke makes no reference to the 12 accepting Paul's apostolate, or you could say apostleship. Of course, the four gospel accounts have no mention of Paul, and thus offer no basis to confirm Paul as an apostle. It is also clear from Acts that the apostles themselves understood their number was set at 12, but that this did not include Paul. Long before Revelation 2:2 was written, we know from Acts 1:21 through 26 that the 12th apostle, Matthias, was chosen to replace Judas. The apostles' criteria for the replacement was that it had to be someone who was with the others from the beginning of Jesus' ministry. Luke reveals, therefore, that the 11 had a criteria that would likewise exclude adding Paul as an apostle. And going forward, I'm going to try to remember to replace Jesus with Yahusha or the Messiah and God with Yahuwah, just so that you know. But this author does not use replaced names. Then Yahusha in the book of Revelation reveals 12 is the number of apostles for all time. The verse of Revelation 21:14 follows the mention that 12 gates of the New Jerusalem, each gate has a name of the 12 tribes of Israel on it. Revelation 21:14 then says, the city was built on 12 foundation stones. On each of the stones was written the name of one of the Lamb's 12 apostles. Revelation 21:14. There is a clear correspondence of one apostle for each of the 12 tribes, gates, and foundation stones. The number each time is only 12. It implies there are not supposed to be more than 12 apostles. You cannot have 13 or 14 apostles judging the 12 tribes. Yahusha made this clear during his earthly ministry as well. Yahusha said, the role of the 12 apostles was to sit upon 12 thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. Matthew 19:28. I'm going to pause there for your comment and check the dashboard. Okay, so there is a clear correspondence of one apostle. Okay, I read that paragraph. The apostles understood it the same way. When Judas fell away and was lost, they added Matthias to bring their number back to 12. Acts 1:22-26. When apostles were martyred later, such as Apostle James, the brother of John, mentioned in Acts 12:2, the apostles did not replace him. Had they done so, this would bring their number to 13 in the resurrection ruling over the New Jerusalem. The apostles must have seen the mismatch where a 13th apostle would represent in fulfilling their role as 12 judges over the 12 tribes into eternity. Alan Johnson in the Calvinist Expositor's Bible Commentator agrees the early church treated the offices of the 12 apostles as dying with them. They were not to be replaced. Their number of 12 was unique. I think herein lies, this is a fascinating study and very much hinges on the awakening of those that are willing to awaken to the fact of who Paul really is. But one of the things that is really important about this is that Paul's ministry was built on flattery. As we know, Daniel states the Antichrist will come bearing flatteries. And I believe part of those flatteries were to flatter men in their own tendency to have self-pride. And in doing so, they were proud of the office that they held. And that's one of the first things that a Christian church will do when you enter their church and become a member is want to find out what your gifts are and what office you may hold. Do you hold the office of a prophet, the office of a teacher, the office of an apostle, an evangelist, and so on and so forth, prayer warrior, bishop, deacon in the church, and so forth and so on. So when we find out that those positions were made up by Paul and that under the Messiah we're all brethren, then all of a sudden his modus operandi to flatter is gone and the finger is pointed to him. What are you doing saying you're an apostle when there were only 12? And so this is part of, I think, what obscures reality for a lot of people, because they really need that little bit of power to hold on to and self-identity of, what their own office is, and if they recognize Paul for who he is, they have to recognize they are part of the brethren, and everyone in the kingdom is basically on an equal level playing field. Thoughts?
Yep, excellent concept. Clarification. The true brotherhood. It's interesting that Mattathiahu, the one who was chosen by Lot to be numbered amongst the 12 of the other 11, to be make the 12 after Judas went to the place where he fell to, is also a gift. So with the other, there's two Mattathiahus that were the taught ones of Messiah. And the name itself means a gift of Yahuwah. And so I think that's neat that a double portion was found amongst those who looked to the taught ones of our Messiah.
Right.
And there's no, which is also an indicator of favor of our Father when we receive a double portion. It's the inheritance of the firstborn. It's interesting that I found what I believe to be the food trough that our Messiah, that Yahushua was swaddled and clothed and laid in during the time of Sukkot, his birth, or at the time of his birth, I'm presuming it's Sukkot. That it was literally a double portion trough that cut out of stone that was meant for the two goats that were kept there by the temple service as the goats of atonement. They had two as one for a back. They actually have four, but when it got down to the time, it was just down to two to make sure that they had a one with. No, it was just the two goats for atonement, but they each had a backup. But at that time, he stayed in the cave where they were set apart to perform that service in the field of Ephrata next to Bethlehem and Yisrael.
Right.
So a double portion, yeah, is a gift from our master when we follow his way, his taught one, what he teaches.
That's an interesting point, because I do feel that I don't know that you would call it a gift. That's what Paul tends to call it. But there are manifestations upon certain individuals that are pronounced, like being able to know things before they happen, or have a prophetic sight. And so
yeah.
that would make sense for to be in line with the Father's words, what is truly Scripture, that what such a person's received a double portion doesn't mean that they're sitting in that office or whatnot. And I think it also has to do with, you know, speaking of, we touched on rulers of evil and one of the last broadcasts, and that whole study of the Freemason Jesuit priest order and so forth, how the black pope behind the white pope, the dark control that most people don't even know is there, called the hidden hand.
The superior general.
Yes. Do things to us like fluoride and things to calcify the pituitary gland and make us more manageable and less perceptive and less in tune with our Creator and less desiring of getting in tune with our Creator, because it's a world we do not know. We're removed from it just from health standpoint. So
all in your senses. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's not my general. I follow the commander of the host of the Shamayim, the heaven. Just to make a point. Because words do matter.
Still on?
Yeah, we're still on.
find out.
Okay, so let's see what we're going to have here next. So Alan Johnson in the Calvinist Expositor's Bible Commentator agreed the early church treated the offices of the 12 apostles as dying with them. They were not to be replaced. Their number of 12 was unique. As to whether the authoritative function of apostles continued after the first century, the apostolic fathers are instructive. In no case did the many references to apostles in the writings of Clement of Rome, Ignatius, Barnabas, and the Shepherd of Hermes relate to any recognized apostles other than those associated with the New Testament. The fathers apparently understood the special apostolic function on earth to have ceased with the end of the apostolic era. Luke and Acts made it evident there were only 12 apostles for all time, and this excluded Paul. Never does Paul claim in Acts to be an apostle of Yahusha. Never do the apostles describe Paul as an apostle. This has been recognized by all Pauline scholars, for example, John Croson and Jonathan Reed in their last work of 2004. In all his letters, Paul sees himself as an apostle sent from God through Christ. The very vocation for which Paul lives is denied him by Luke. He is, to be sure, an important missionary, but he is not an apostle equal to the 12. Furthermore, Croson and Reed make the point that Luke's story of how Matthias replaced Judas excludes the possibility of a 13th apostle such as Paul. They write, Luke insists in Acts chapter 1 that after Yahusha's resurrection, there were still always and only the 12 apostles. For Luke, Paul is simply not an apostle. Without Matthias' explicit selection, one might have imagined that Luke's Paul was at least implicitly Judas's replacement as the 12th apostle. With it, Luke implies that Paul was not an apostle and could never be one. He could never be the one thing Paul always insisted that he was, namely an apostle sent by Yahuwah through a revelation of the risen Elohim, or master. It says Lord here. So I find that interesting, too, to realize that there was intent on deception as to what books did go into the Bible and which ones did not, and yet there was enough seed placed there that those intent on finding the truth like us would be able to find it. So it really is as though there are two paths placed in the Bible set before us. Choose this day in whom you will serve. Choose life or death. And you have to be able to recognize his fingerprints.
Very clear to me. I agree. Yeah, we're...
Yeah. It's almost like when Satan and a third of the angels fell, there was a negotiation made. All right, you know, Satan, I envisioned him as bragging that he was going to bring us with him and that we would want to go, and that the Father allowed him to put that to the test, but that before us had to be enough truth that those that would love the Father and his side and his holy ways would be able to find it. That's kind of how I envision it. I don't know what you guys.
That's pretty cool envision.
So thus the only person to say Paul is an apostle of Yahusha in the entire New Testament is Paul himself. Yet we know that Yahusha said if he alone bore witness to himself, then his witness would be untrue. John 5:31. If I bear witness of myself, my witness is not true. Yahusha was extending the law's principle so that two witnesses were necessary to establish not only a wrong, but also anything as important as Yahuwah sending someone for a special role. In fact, Yahusha in Revelation 2:2 clearly agrees a self-serving claim to be his apostle is insufficient. Thus, Paul's claim to being an apostle thus suffers from being self-serving. By a biblical standard from Yahusha himself, Paul's self-witness is not true. Thus, the identity of the person who said he was an apostle to the Ephesians in Revelation 2:2, but who could not be an apostle is proven from the Bible itself. Honest Pauline scholars have conceded this underlying problem to Paul's validity. His claim to apostleship is uncorroborated, and thus Yahusha says Paul's claim is not true. John 5:31. As a result, it is obvious the person spoke of in Revelation 2:2 is Paul, because the New Testament gives us a record of, turn the page. Only one person told the Ephesians he was an apostle who was in fact not one of the 12 apostles. A complete record of the 12 apostles in Acts excludes Paul. In Acts, Paul was never recognized as an apostle by the 12, and in Acts, Paul never claims to be an apostle of Yahusha, and thus no record exists of an authoritative acceptance by the 12 of Paul as such an apostle. Paul and Luke mention a heresy trial of Paul at Ephesus. I was just thinking about that. Is there any evidence in the Bible that the Ephesians determined Paul was not an apostle? Yes, Paul and Luke both mention that Paul was subject to a heresy trial at Ephesus, a city of Asia, Western Turkey. Paul likewise mentions that all the churches of Asia, Western Turkey, thereafter came to reject Paul. We are puzzled by these verses, and we pass over them. However, in light of Revelation 2:2, Yahuwah has given us this evidence so we can apply Revelation 2:2. Some background on Ephesus is necessary to understand the Bible passages at issue. Ephesus was in the province of Asia. This was not near China. Rather, it was a Roman province along the west coast of modern Turkey near Greece. Differentiate this Asia from the Far East, it is sometimes called Proconsular Asia. Ephesus was Proconsular Asia's leading city. Ephesus had a population of 250,000. In 2 Timothy, Paul talks of a trial he endured in a Christian congregation. Paul says he put up his first defense among them. However, Paul says all forsook me, 2 Timothy 4:14 through 17. In an exact parallel, Paul identifies in the same epistle that this trial took place in Asia, where Ephesus is the capital. Paul writes that all the Christians of Asia defected from him. What else, other than heresy trial at Asia's leading church of Ephesus, can explain this action? In 2 Timothy 1:15, Paul writes, "This thou knowest, that all that are in Asia turned away from me, of whom are Phygellus and Hermogenes." So one thought is that we know the New Testament is not written in order. And one thought, and I believe it's outlined in this book later on very clearly, is that this trial took place in between Acts. Where are the three chapters where he talks about his vision? It's Acts chapter 9, 21, and 26. Is that correct? Okay, so it's thought that...
this 15.
Okay.
Yeah, Acts 15, 16.
Okay, well, we can call it... Version 1, 2, and 3. So somewhere between versions 2 and version 3, this trial took place. And thus, and we've read on air before as well, Peter's letter to Paul basically challenging him, if you be an apostle, then thus and such, why are you against us? Why do you reject us? Why do you lift yourself above the original apostles, basically, and also, why does it sound as though if your vision of Yahusha is real, and he spent all this time walking with us and talking with us and teaching us in person, and then mysteriously you have a vision, and all of the doctrine we were taught changes. If this were true, then why does it sound as though you're being admonished by this entity that you say appeared to you rather than blessed?
This is different with me. Yeah.
And all of a sudden, in his third version, he's being given compliments by this entity that appeared. So, which is basically a blessing for us, because we know that when testimony changes, one of the testimonies is untrue. If a testimony is untrue, the person's lied. If you have a liar, you have somebody you can't rely on that has no credibility. So in so doing, he threw us a bone, those of us that have eyes to see and can open our eyes. And, you know, I know that the Paulines defend him ad nauseum and come up with all kinds of, well, that was then and this is now, and it changed and it changed again and so forth and so on. But when you have Malachi 3 saying, I am Yahuwah, I change not, then you need to pay attention to that. He didn't stutter. So.
No, he did not. Yeah, thanks for reading that through. That was a there's a good flow there as far as like all the evidences leading up to the trial of Paul in that section of the book. We're going to read some more?
Yes. Paulinists have no explanation of this verse except to deny Paul's words. Adam Clark says Paul must be referring to Asiatic Christians at Rome. He cannot be speaking of any general defection of the Asiatic church. However, Asia is primarily two major cities, Ephesus and Smyrna. It is not that hard to believe such a defection took place. We're not talking of a large area covering many major churches. Furthermore, Clark has no explanation for denying Paul, means what he says. It is self-evident. Clark is appealing to our respect for Paul. We cannot imagine Paul is thinking so low.
Yeah.
Thus, even Paul's own words, that all in Asia turned away from me, cannot convince those devoted to Paul that what Paul says is true. However, contrary to Clark's spin, Luke in Acts chapter 19 records the events leading to what Paul mentioned in 2 Timothy 1:15 and 4:14-17. Luke records that the budding church of Ephesus decided at one point to have nothing further to do with Paul. In fact, Luke appears to be implying a heresy trial of Paul took place at Ephesus in Asia. Here is what Luke records in Acts 19:1, 8, and 9. Paul came to Ephesus, and he entered into the synagogue at Ephesus and spake boldly for the space of 3 months, reasoning and persuading as to the things concerning the kingdom of Yahuwah, that when some were hardened and disobedient, speaking evil of the way before the multitude, he departed from them. Thus, in Luke's account, Paul no longer went to the budding church at Ephesus, where he had been persuading them for 3 months. While it appears the leadership favored Paul, he encountered opposition eventually from some influential members. Clearly, this event would be a muted way that a friend, like Luke, would record a heresy trial. So let's read that again. Paul came to Ephesus, and he entered into the synagogue at Ephesus and spake boldly for the space of 3 months, reasoning and persuading as to the things concerning the kingdom of Yahuwah. But when some were hardened and disobedient, speaking evil of the way before the multitude, he departed from them. I remember when I read that and realized that the perspective had been switched. That was like the second step, the first step being when Paul said, I caught you with trickery, 2 Corinthians 12:16, when he admits that he caught the people with, he beguiled them. And I thought, that's something that the serpent does, not a man of Yahuwah. But this was my second clue here, and I realized that I was looking at a negative, like when you look at film and you see the negative, you see the reverse image, and that when you, get your film developed, and then you see the image that was actually there. So I could see this, that the negative image was put before me, not as in a bad situation, but a negative as in the reverse image, the reverse perspective. So I could see that the way that was being spoken of was the new way that Paul brought that was not true, and that the ones who had hardened their heart to Paul were the ones holding fast to the way that was established eternally. And I was like, wow. It was just like my eyes were opened, and then that was kind of the doorway to where we are today with this. But do y'all understand what I'm saying as far as the film development and seeing the negative image?
Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah, and it's really hard to explain to other people, and it's something that unless you have it opened up to you in your own heart and mind as understanding, it just sounds like words on paper, and I don't know, people are like, huh? It's the great switcheroo. It was the beginning of the great switcheroo and the proof that not all were deceived into the switcheroo gospel, and they held fast to the Messiah's original way. Yet this parallels what Yahushua spoke about 20 years later in Revelation 2:2. There was a trial at Ephesus of a person who said he was an apostle, but who was not and could not be an apostle. Paul in 2 Corinthians again recalls this defection among Christians of Asia. He says it felt like he was under the sentence of death. In 2 Corinthians 1:8-9, Paul writes, "For we would not have you ignorant, brethren, concerning our affliction which befell us in Asia, that we were weighed down exceedingly beyond our power, insomuch that we despaired, even of life. Yea, we ourselves have had the sentence of death within ourselves, that we should not trust in ourselves, but in Yahuwah, who raiseth the dead." Hence Paul alludes to an affliction in proconsular Asia, in which Ephesus was the leading city, which felt like an experience of a death sentence. The fact Paul was not killed is proof he is speaking figuratively. A church heresy verdict in Asia would perfectly fit Paul's meaning. If Paul were the one Yahushua has in mind in Revelation 2:2, someone tried as a false claimant to be an apostle, such a verdict would be like a sentence of death. It would be a crushing blow to Paul's evangelism. Evidence of the actual verdict at Ephesus in the writings of Tertullian in 207 A.D. Let me check the dashboard here. Okay. We're missing our sidekick this morning, Ron.
Yes, be honest.
So, let me message him. Sometimes he's over there in Egypt, right?
He is. On Cairo, I believe. Is that where he's from, babe?
Cairo, yeah, Cairo, Egypt.
Or living not from. From L.A. to Cairo.
Pretty amazing. It appears in 207 A.D. that Tertullian, in a work entitled Against Marcion, memorializes the actual verdict at Ephesus against Paul. Tertullian is a leading member of the church at Carthage and a prolific writer on Christian themes. He is one of the most respected of all the Christian writers who predate the Roman Catholic era, which began in 325 A.D. To understand Tertullian's words about Paul, we need to lay some background on church doctrine of that era and on Marcion. The early church commentators in the 125 through 325 AD period universally rejected almost all uniquely Pauline doctrines. Instead, in that period, almost all doctrine belonged to James's teachings. This is never disputed by Paulinus, the first Orthodox post-apostolic thinker who Paulinus ever cite as holding Pauline doctrine is Augustine from the late 300 AD. He was the first and only Christian voice to espouse predestination as taught by Paul. He also spoke of the gift of perseverance. Augustine was a leading Roman Catholic figure whose writings date to the 4th century. However, there was someone prior to Augustine who held Pauline doctrines on grace and salvation. It was Marcion. He arose around 144 AD. The writings of Tertullian were often on the lips of Calvin and Luther. David C. No, PhD, Cloud of Witnesses, 2004, Bethel Presbyterian Church. I often see Marcion as the subject of Matthew chapter 13, where it talks about the wheat versus the tares and the one who went to sow the tares. Because Marcion was a shipbuilder, but he had something to do with ships, and he was often on ships. And he took Pauline's epistles, and wherever he went, he scattered them to, you know, spread the quote-unquote good news from his perspective.
Yeah. So,
the beginning of the, how would you say, fulfillment of the prophecy that Daniel wrote about, right? Well, and that, for that matter, Jacob, when it says, Benjamin, in the morning you will plunder, and in the evening you will divide the spoil.
Divide the spoil.
So, and Paul did that. He killed in the beginning of his ministry, or in the beginning, and in the end, he took this spoil, the riches of the Father, and he divided them until they were no longer meaningful in their original form, and therefore added leaven to it, and therefore became a deceiver. So, and that's Genesis 49:23, and it's been a while since I've quoted it, so I'm sure I botched it pretty badly. I don't know if somebody can look that up.
Genesis 9?
Genesis 49:23. Well, I thought that was what I was trying to say, but that's not.
Is it 27?
Maybe. Yeah, Benjamin shall raven as a wolf in the morning. He shall devour the prey. And at night, he shall divide the spoil. So, and there's that reference to him being a wolf, too. And that's when the Messiah came to warn of the deceiver, he referred to him as a wolf, which is that link for us in the Father's words for us to basically have a clue that this is the same one that I warned you of, the one to come. And who else from the tribe of Benjamin has fulfilled that? Ask, if you don't think Paul's a bad guy, who else has fulfilled that?
That's a good point.
Mm-hmm. So despite Marcion's core doctrines agreeing with Paul, the early church in that period pursued Marcion and his followers as heretics. The Marcionites clearly held Paul's doctrine of salvation by faith alone as the true gospel. Marcion insisted the 12 apostles and their gospel narratives were wrong on the doctrine of grace. Marcion claimed their gospel narratives were for the era of law. Marcion opted for a narrative of Yahusha's life that reads a lot like Luke's gospel. However, it is missing the first three chapters of Luke and a few other passages. Based on Paul's letters to the Galatians, Marcion claimed the law of Moses was abrogated. We do not have to obey the Yahuwah of the Old Testament, but only the God of the New. To encounter this movement, the issue of Paul's validity had to be resolved. It is in this...
I said, and then they changed the good news, the gospel.
Mm-hmm.
Right along that goes guideline.
Yep, and then, there's been such an attack on Christian faith that we don't do this any longer, but I know for years when I was in elementary school, once a year we had to all get a New Testament Bible. You know, the little bitty Bibles that were just the New Testament. Well, I mean, why do we need an Old Testament if it's been done away with? So basically that therein lies the indoctrination of teaching people to just follow the New and not know the Elohim of the Old Testament. And the New, as we know now, is filled with truth and error. I mean, you know, the leaven of Paul. So, and that kind of led to the encouragement of people to just go to church and follow their pastor that would just basically preach Proverbs, Psalms, and Paul with once in a while a verse from Yahusha that was slanted to meet Paul's statement, not the other way around.
Well, you got a good source of toilet paper if you ever run out of any. If you have a scripture lying around and has Paul's writings in it. Push comes to shove.
You blasphemer. All right. Tertullian's point about Paul, where what Tertullian wrote about Paul's validity has the earmarks of what one would expect would be a judicial decision at Ephesus involving Paul. Tertullian makes the following sobering points about Paul. Yahusha never made Paul an apostle from the records that we can read. Paul's claim to apostleship solely relies upon Paul's veracity.
His own word.
His own word.
I'm sorry, I thought we were muted.
He was saying his own word.
His own word, yeah, his own veracity.
He was saying his own, yeah.
Right.
Paul.
If Paul were a true apostle, he is still an inferior apostle because Paul in Acts 15 submitted his doctrine to the 12. Interesting. If Paul later varied from the 12, we must regard the 12 as more authoritative than Paul because he came later. Paul's claim of being selected as an apostle later by Yahusha seems implausible. That story asks us to believe Yahusha had not planned things adequately with the 12. Lastly, Yahushua warned us of false prophets who would come doing miracles in his name and signs and wonders, and Paul perfectly matches that prophesied type of prophet. Isn't that amazing that we're warned about that, and then he comes literally word for word. It's not even hidden. Literally word for word, he comes claiming that he came to us in signs and in wonders and in the spirit of Jesus Christ. And I think that where he always hooks in the Jesus Christ and gains his credibility on that, we don't say, hey, wait a minute, we were warned about you, buddy.
Yeah, that's how strong traditions are.
Mm-hmm.
It really, really gets in the marrow, and then it becomes a life of the culture, and the truth is forgotten.
Yep.
Just like Benjamin is related to a wolf that tears,
mm-hmm.
Even that reminds me of all those who eat flesh. It's, you know, you have to tear into that. And they seem to be predominantly Pauline supporters as well.
Mm-hmm.
Certain mindset.
This passage from Tertullian is quoted verbatim later in this book at page 408. Tertullian's words are an echo of precisely what one would expect to hear in a sensible verdict about Paul at Ephesus. Tertullian is apparently revealing to us the findings in the Revelation 2:2 hearing. Paul is not to be regarded as an apostle on par with the 12, if at all. Whatever Paul truly represents in Yahuwah's eyes, in our finite eyes, we must realize Paul is subject to the authority and superior teaching of the 12. Finally, Tertullian said Paul possibly is a liar and a false prophet because he came in the name of Yahusha with signs and wonders and only had himself as a witness of his apostolic status. You know, this is probably a good place to insert this too. It's also interesting that the one that Paul names as quote-unquote Christ, he tries to paint the image in people's minds as he's speaking to them that he's referring to the man that walked and taught the 12. But then it becomes clear that he is not, because when he talks about this one that he refers to as the Christ, there are distinct differences, such as that even in the sinner's prayer, that this one was raised from the dead by Yahuwah, whereas Yahusha in John says that for this reason the Father doth love me, that I have laid down my life that I may raise it up again. And so if you're not paying attention, you don't see that this is a different entity. So it's interesting that he holds fast to his credibility and encourages others to do so as well, based on his rubbing elbows, so to speak, with the Christ, when the Christ he's referring to can't be the one that walked in the book of Matthew in the first place.
Yeah, well, he got his word in first, as well, like was, and he was going to report to the elders and the emissaries in Jerusalem as he was going through Asia the first time. He was proclaiming his version of that news at that time and making people joyful. So
right.
It's kind of hard for the guy to come along behind that with the truth, which touches some points but is twisted in others, for them to become unraveled, so to speak, to be able to attend to the truth.
Well, and exactly, and it goes back to that point of the people being utterly and totally deceived, but yet if they would just look at things logically and simply do the math, there's no way that he could be telling the truth. It's just that he's saying what we want to hear. That's it. But as all deceivers do.
Yep.
Yeah, true.
Good point.
There's something on the tip of my tongue that I'm trying to get across to you, that how absolutely simple the truth is. It's you know, when you sit in math class, 2 can't be 3 and 3 can't be 2 ever. 2 will never be 3 and 3 will never be 2. And in this case, Yahusha raised himself from the dead, and the Jesus Christ that Paul talks about was raised from the dead by God, by Yahuwah, by God, I say, because his God is pagan.
Yeah.
We're not talking about the same entity. There's other places to prove this as well. So when people say, I preach Christ and him crucified, well, first of all, if you're going to make a statement like that, you should be focusing on the resurrection, not the crucifixion, because something very eventful happened after the crucifixion that makes this whole thing meaningful. So it's very strange that you'd be fixated on the death, not the resurrection. But secondly, who are you speaking of when you say Christ and him crucified? You're trying to attach in people's mind the crucifixion of the Messiah. You're making reference to Paul's entity that he refers to that came and visited him in the desert and that had to be raised by God and came in the likeness of sinful flesh, meaning copy of, not the thing, the counterfeit, if you go back to the original. And anti doesn't just mean against, it means not the real thing, the copy of. And so what you've got is this false prophet creating a false image of a Christ, but because it's false, becomes a beast. It's not real reality. It's not the blessing. It's the curse. And so now you start to look at Revelation and all of this foreign language about the false prophet that gives life to the beast that was crucified, that died and then lived, and you're set back a few notches and kind of go, wow, this great deception that we always wondered how in the world it would be so great that it would deceive most of the people in the world is in the church itself and in the Bible itself. Are you kidding me? Oh, that's why it's so great. It's in the very book people put their hands on to swear an oath that they're telling the truth, in the very book that people rely on when they're getting married, and the very book that parents point their children to for good upbringing. And it's just wild that it's just right there in front of us. And then we realize that the Father is living, and the truth that are in that book are everlasting. But we must ask ourselves with every verse, is this a part of the everlasting covenant, or is this a part of the deception? There are two clear paths in the Bible. This is not all a book of instruction. It is a book of two paths and set before us for us to choose in which way we will walk.
Is it very good fruit, or is it rotten? Two paths.
Yes. Okay. Getting close to the end here, believe it or not. Okay, so this passage from Tertullian is quoted verbatim later in his book at page 408. Tertullian's words are an echo of precisely what one would expect to hear in a sensible verdict about Paul of Ephesus. Tertullian is apparently revealing to us the findings in the Revelation 2:2 hearing. Paul is not to be regarded as an apostle on par with the 12, if at all. Whatever Paul truly represents in Yahuwah's eyes, in our finite eyes, we must realize Paul is subject to the authority and superior teaching of the 12. Finally, Tertullian said, Paul possibly is a liar and false prophet because he came in the name of Yahusha with signs and wonders and only had himself as a witness of his apostolic status. Tertullian said this meant Paul potentially fits Yahusha's express warning about false prophets. Thus, Tertullian concluded, we must quote from Paul cautiously. In other words, only if Paul's words solidly line up with Yahusha's words should we follow Paul's words. Tertullian's teachings not only reflect apparently the ruling at Ephesus, but they also explain why we see the early church never following most of Paul's core teachings. This pattern continued for almost two millennia until Luther revived Paulinism. In earliest Christianity, Paul must have been deemed inferior by the church at large, particularly on issues of salvation, or else the following facts make no sense. The early church leaders from 125 to 325 AD universally reject almost all of Paul's unique doctrines: salvation by faith alone, total depravity, predestination, man lacks free will, docetism, D-O-C-E-T-I-S-M, etc. I don't know what that one is. The Orthodox Church, now totaling 250 million members, can trace back its origins to that same early church. It existed in territories outside of the Roman Empire and was free, therefore, to reject most of the errors later arising in Roman Catholicism. Doctrines are identical to the early church of 125 through 325 AD. To this day, the Orthodox reject all of Paul's uniquely Pauline doctrines. Furthermore, in direct contravention of Paul's directive in Galatians, the Orthodox also keep the Mosaic Law's command to rest on the Saturday Sabbath. The Orthodox claim it was never abrogated. They have always also worshipped on Sunday. Roman Catholicism in the form we know it today arose after 325 AD. Despite all its flaws, it still retained some of the core teaching of James and Jesus on salvation, claiming sin causes loss of salvation. Thus, Catholicism has always rejected Paul's faith alone and eternal security teaching. Augustine, however, misled Catholicism to adopt a sacramental system where the church dispensed regeneration by baptism even to infants without faith. The Catholic Church also did accept two doctrines espoused uniquely by Paul: original sin and the abrogation of the Mosaic Law. Abrogating Saturday Sabbath for Christians. Thus, Catholicism in 363 AD broke the prior nearly universal tradition among Christians of keeping Saturday Sabbath. By contrast, the Orthodox, who long ago severed ties with Roman Catholicism, reject the doctrine of original sin and Mariology. I guess that's what they're calling Marcion's followers, while they have kept the Saturday Sabbath for 2,000 years. This history demonstrates that the main church, other than heretics, all rejected Paul's unique core teaching for almost two millennia. Tertullian's words show a judicious approach to Paul as if rendered by a court. Paul can be listened to insofar as he does not contradict the Messiah, but we do not treat Paul as inspired ever. We make no effort to bend Yahusha's words to fit Paul's words. That appears to be the actual verdict at Ephesus. This explains why Paul's writings were allowed to be connected physically to the Lord's gospel. With a proper introduction, it was believed Paul's letters could be read for whatever worth they held. Otherwise, any teaching at odds with Yahusha, Paul had to be and was ignored. One of the things that occurs to me through studying this is that if a person were to turn 100% away to a different doctrine that was not connected with truth, then it would be much more likely for them to have understanding of that and to feel evil inside. But I think that hook and that connection to the truth by draping untruth over it so that some of it shines through, so to speak, makes a person feel holy or forgiven or heaven-bound while they are utterly pagan. And that's where the real deception comes into play, because people aren't leaving the truth for Satanism. They're leaving it for twisted truth. And so therefore, we have all of the traditions like Christmas and Halloween and January 1st being the new year to honor the god Janus. I mean, on and on and on. The twisting of the truth is shown up in our traditions. But we fundamentally feel like good people that are his and blessed by him, and we call ourselves his, when we're not following him at all. But we feel like we are because at some level we believe the root of what we believe in came from him, but it just changed. And that's why I've heard it called Twistianity, the Pauline version. Yeah. Anyway.
Doctrine.
Yeah.
Another different gospel. Good news, Pastor Ross. A lot of corruption through the years.
Mm-hmm.
By the hand and pens of men.
All right. So Tertullian's comments on Paul's validity, therefore, if affixed as an introduction to Paul's letters, would allow us to sift the good from the bad. Tertullian's thoughts on Paul were forgotten or ignored by Luther and Calvin. Their emphasis on Paul's words broke every caution that Tertullian put up in 2007 AD. Thus, the Reformation was launched in the 1520s based on Paul's writings without remembering how the church had kept Paul subordinate to the 12. Paul was subordinate in particular to the four gospel accounts of teachings of Yehoshua. The subordination apparently has been cemented in the verdict in Revelation 2:2. Paul's place in the church was decreed at Ephesus. Jesus commended the verdict in Revelation 2:2. It stood solid until the 1520s, when Luther began proclaiming once again, like Marcion, the gospel of Paul. That's just absolutely fascinating for people that use dispensationalism as the reason for the change. Well, then there was another dispensational change in Revelation. I mean, you have the Messiah proclaiming that Paul is false in Revelation.
That's good enough for me.
Absolutely. I mean, that cements it. So,
I always prefer the words of the Messiah over a man that says, follow me.
Mm-hmm. So why is Paul then in the post-apostolic canon list? As noted above, Tertullian's view of Paul in 2007 AD was that he was inferior to the true apostles. If this was well known and accepted, then why was Paul added within the ensuing century to the New Testament canon? The answer primarily depends on recognition that canon back then did not mean what we mean by canon today. If we had the same concept of canon today as back then, we would be willing to include popular writers in our New Testament along with the inspired writers. We might attach the writings of C.S. Lewis or Billy Graham. We would know the difference. We would acknowledge both our inferior to the 12 apostles and Jesus, but we could still read them both for edification. This was Jerome's express understanding of canon in 411 AD. I think that gives profound testimony to the fact that you can't give the devil an inch. He'll take a mile.
Yeah.
That's true.
That year, Jerome personally affixed the Apocrypha to his complete translation of the Bible. This Bible was known as the Latin Vulgate. Jerome clearly said he added the Apocrypha solely because it was edifying. Its connection did not signify the Apocrypha could be used as the basis of doctrine. In other words, it was not inspired. This was also clearly the same point Tertullian made about Paul's writings in August in Against Marcion, 207 AD. Tertullian demonstrated a judicious approach. He affirms Paul is not a true apostle and even is possibly a false prophet. Tertullian goes on to say, Paul is my apostle. He finds edifying doctrines of Paul that are consistent with Yahusha. Tertullian was not ignoring Paul and had contrary doctrine to Jesus on salvation and eternal security. Tertullian goes to great lengths to refute Paul's contrary doctrines without mentioning Paul's name. Why did Tertullian make any effort to retain Paul for edification purposes while making otherwise highly critical observations about him and his doctrines? The reason appears obvious. Tertullian is battling the Marcionites. They claim Paul alone has the true gospel. It is a gospel where obedience does not matter anymore. Yahuwah saves the believer and no longer judges one for disobedience. The Marcionites insist the 12 apostles were legalistic. The 12 presented a Yahusha who made salvation turn on obedience. The Yahusha of the 12 did not present the gospel of Paul. The 12's gospel belonged to the Yahuwah of the Old Testament. Paul's gospel belonged to the God of the New Testament. Tertullian was obviously struggling to find a solution to this excessive marginalization of Jesus. What solution did Tertullian choose? It was simple. He chose good politics. We can hold on to Paul, read him for edification purposes, but we must realize he is not inspired. He is not on par with the 12. This is what explains Paul's presence in later canon lists. Thus, early canon lists, which add Paul, can only be understood in light of Marcionism. Marcionite Paul-onlyism was bravely fought off by the church. The price of peace was that Yahusha's true apostles had preeminence, but Paul's writings could be read for edification. And we're getting very, very close to the end, so that's a good stopping place.
Okay.
A good read today.
It was. A lot of information.
Well, thank you. Glad you guys were able to get on.
Yeah.
We're glad to spend some time with you.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we enjoy reading these books that we don't always get to read.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, you guys take care and keep in touch. And to our radio audience, we look forward to seeing you back here next time.
Yes.
It'll be next Sunday. And that'll be noon Pacific, 9 Pacific, noon Eastern, subtract an hour for each time zone that you're in. So 11 Central, 10 Mountain, 9 Pacific. So everybody have a wonderful day, and thanks for joining us today.
Yeah.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye.